Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. Let's talk about sex. That's what we do here. We talk about the saxophone. And today we have a gentleman in Belgium who is keeping Adolf Sax's name alive, ladies and gentlemen. His name is Carl. I'm not going to try his last name. Yeah, I know how I can get. But he is manufacturing saxophones in the name of Adolf Sax. Yes. Let's talk about sax. Okay. This is an interview I did with Carl. He's going to go in more detail about what it is that he does. So let's just segue right into that interview. All right, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all. This is Let's Talk About Sax, and we have the man himself, Carl Hudenberg. Did I get it right? I messed it up, didn't I?
Yeah, but I did a good job for an American. It's pronounced Hudenberg.
Okay.
But that's not easy for non-Dutch natives.
It's not easy. I will agree. It's not easy. Carl manufactures saxophone in Belgium, in Denon, and I may have mispronounced that as well, under the name of Adolf Sax, which is remarkable. He's keeping his name alive, manufacturing saxophones where the saxophone was born. And that's just a great thing to be doing. When did you start to play the saxophone?
Well, it basically started when I was 4 or 5 years old. Oh, wow. A friend of my parents walked in and he just got a saxophone. And for some reason, they handed it over to me. Hmm. And I put my mouth to it and I start blowing. Mm-hmm. And it made a sound. And it left such a big impression on me that I was like, wow, I need to play saxophone. But I was too young at that time. So I had to wait till I was 12 years old to go to the music school.
Right.
And I went there with full enthusiasm, like, yeah, I'm going to nail it. But 3 weeks later, I didn't touch a saxophone. I haven't touched it. I was like, when are we going to play saxophone? And the teacher made clear that first you go through 3 years of music theory, and then maybe you get to choose between piano and guitar. And I'm like, what? String instruments? That's inferior. I cannot do it. So I decided to quit music school, and I decided for myself, okay, you know what, maybe I only have a talent to enjoy music, which is also very important. And I remember when I was 19, I just quit school and I did some volunteers work in abroad, and I returned back to Belgium and I walked into a music shop and I was determined to buy a saxophone. So I went up to this guy and I asked, hey, what's the cheapest saxophone you have? And he said something, it was an amount similar to $1,300.
Right.
I was like, that's too much for me. I mean, my pockets were empty. I did volunteer's work, so that doesn't really pay well.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the guy, you know what? Sell me a reed. And I'll keep that reed as a promise to myself. One day, I'll have my own saxophone. And it looked kind of strange to me, but I was like, okay, you know what? He sold me that reed. And it was a Select Jazz from Rico, now the Dario.
Right, right.
Too soft it was. it took till I was 27 to start playing it. I just had money in my hands, got a saxophone, a tenor saxophone, and started to play by myself first. Then after 10 months of messing around myself, and I enjoyed it. And I was quite good at it. I went to music school.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was, my teacher was a classical saxophonist, and I wanted to play jazz because jazz, no, it's the only righteous way to handle a saxophone is to play jazz on it.
Hey, and, preach. I hear you.
And she was, well, she didn't really like me. She wanted me to play classical music and children's songs, and I refused. I had moral obligations. I said, I'm like, no, I couldn't do it. My saxophone and I were not made to play classical music and children's songs. So it was a troubled relationship we had. I mean, she made me get rid of my Otolink Florida 7-star. She hated it. I had to play on a Selmer mouthpiece. I hated it, but you know what? Sometimes you have to get along.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And how did you get into the manufacturing part of it? I mean, from there, continue, but.
Well, 2 years later, playing saxophone in the music school and conservatory, me getting frustrated, my teacher getting frustrated, all of a sudden, I have an accident with my bicycle, breaking my vertebra. And my vertebra and my back was crushed and broken in 3 places. And I actually shrunk 1/2 inch due to the accident.
Oh,
and the doctors told me I would be disabled for a certain percentage and I would be in permanent pain for the rest of my life. And I was like, don't tell me something is permanent. I get to decide it. But I had to admit, it hurt. My back hurt so much that I couldn't play saxophone anymore. So I ended up being so frustrated. I really wanted to do something with saxophone that I decided to take apart my own saxophone. And I liked that so much. I was so impressed by the ingenuity, the technicality, how everything communicates with each other. It's so impressive. So I decided to get me another old saxophone, and I got myself a Conchu Berry, and I remember when it arrived, I bought it from the States. I opened the box, and the smell of old brass just hit my nostrils, and I was like, wow, I fell in love basically there and then, and that's when I decided to start doing more with saxophones and just looking at it and trying to play it, because the smell of that old brass that actually brought me back to my childhood. I grew up on a shipyard of my grandfather, and we used to work with brass and steel and iron, and that was the same smell. So that's when I really fell in love, and that's how I got started trying to fix and repair saxophones myself. I bought a lot of old saxophones, mainly Americans, because I really I adore American saxophones, I have to say, especially the old ones. And I just studied saxophones, the technicality. I saw that several things were different than the modern day saxophones. Some things that I found on the old saxophones, I couldn't find back on the new ones. So every time I wanted to know why, and that's how I got drawn into the whole repair business and eventually manufacturing business.
So you're self-taught. You taught yourself how to build a saxophone.
That's it. I mean, it's maybe it also has to do with the fact that I'm not, I used to have a problem with authority. So being taught is not an easy thing, or it used to be not so easy for me. So I had to do everything myself and find out the tricks myself.
That's
also very similar to Adolf Sax himself, because he was very creative. He started repairing and making things, even toys, when he was 10 years old. He started making his own toys. At 12, he was helping his father in the factory, because his father also made musical instruments. And his father was also self-taught. So, I don't know. It is a thing that for some people that tend to be a little stubborn, it works better to be self-taught.
If it works for you, it seems to have worked for you in a great way. So your website is adolfsax.be, am I correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
For people who are listening to the podcast, When did the company start?
I started the company in 2012, shortly after I discovered that I could acquire the worldwide rights to the name Adolf Sax.
And how did you go about getting those rights? I can't imagine that it was an easy thing to do.
Well, it was kind of special. In 2012, February 22nd, 2:30 in the morning, I wake up and I hear this very distinct thought in my head, like, okay, you have to look up the name Adolf Sax on the trademark registry. And I was debating with my own thoughts. I was like, give me a break. Everybody knows that in 1929, Selmer from Paris bought the almost bankrupt business of the son of Adolf Sax. And so they probably still have the rights to the name. But I couldn't get back to sleep, so I got up, started my computer, and was like, okay, humor me. And I checked the trademark registry, and it was not registered. So that night, I just started a procedure, and I acquired the worldwide rights to the name Adolf Sax. And that got me started. So as soon as it takes half a year for you get notice that you have the rights, because there's a lot of research being done. And in September 27th of 2012, I gave a press conference announcing that I would relaunch the first saxophone brand in the world, Adolf Sax 2.0. That's what I did.
Did any family members come out of the woodwork? I know he had a brother. He had a son who continued for some years after him. I mean, this is early 1900s when his son, I believe, maybe mid-1900s or something like that, he kept the name going. Did anyone say, hey, wait a minute, that's my great-grandfather or something like that? Did anyone approach you at all from the family?
No. In fact, no. Unfortunately, there are no more living family members of the Sax family, which is a pity because it would be so cool to be acquainted with them.
It would.
Yeah, but nobody's left anymore. Because a lot of the family members, well, they basically died young.
Right.
And if I recall correctly, I don't remember Edward Sax having a lot of kids.
Right. That's what I was wondering about. And how did the local, you told me a story the other day about it. It's such a great story. You have to share it with the people about the locals and how they took to you, you know, starting this company.
Well, I wanted to do a press release in Dinant. That's the birthplace of Adolf Sax. Mm-hmm. That's in the French-speaking part of Belgium. And so I called the mayor's office, and I asked the secretary of the mayor of Dinant, hey, can I give a press release in Dinant because I want to launch a new Belgian saxophone brand? I didn't want to reveal what the name was, just wanted to see if it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, okay, give me a minute, and I'm going to talk to the mayor. 5 minutes later, she comes back, and she says, no, you can't. I'm like, why not? She said, well, here in Dinant, we cooperate with Selmer, and so you can't give your press conference here. And that was the end of the conversation. And I was kind of angry, actually. I was like, what? This is not fair. And I was so frustrated, but I decided, you know what? Let it be. I mean, also Dinant, being the birthplace of Adolf Sax, I think it's not more than a month later, the family already moved from Dinant. And the saxophone was actually invented in Brussels, 1841.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided to do it in Bruges, and I gave a press conference. That's my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
So I gave the press conference, and wow, it was national news. Everybody was so enthusiastic about it. And all of a sudden, a few days later, I receive a phone call from the secretary of the mayor of Dinant. And the secretary said, hey, the mayor of Dinant wants to meet you. I was like, okay. So up I went. And well, The conversation didn't go that smooth. First, he wanted to impress me and sort of intimidate me, but I'm not easily intimidated. Then I saw him trying to put me up against Selmer. I was like, no, you're not going to do this. I don't want to pick a fight with Selmer. I mean, I respect Selmer. And I mean, it's a great company. It really did a lot of good. They actually changed the saxophone
world. Yeah.
They kind of set the standard for modern day saxophones. Yes, so you have to respect them. Yes, but I'm not going to pick a fight with them. So the mayor, well, he saw that he couldn't manipulate me and that I was not really impressed by his persona. So we went our ways, and the years after that, every time when we were on the same events, whenever he saw me, he always went the other way. I was like, oh, too bad for you. I don't care. It's okay. So yeah, that was my encounter with the former mayor of Dinant. Now they have a new mayor, and it seems to go well, Dinant, though.
Okay. So, yeah. Okay.
That's the whole thing. Not everybody is always enthusiastic. I mean, Adolf Sachs in his day, he had a lot of enemies.
Yes, he did.
I mean, they even tried to kill him.
I know.
They stabbed his throat. I mean, it's like, wow. All the intrigues, they stole from him. They torched his workshop. They stole his plans. I mean, they hated him so much. But the reason why they hated him was because he did such an amazing job. You have to know that Adolf Sachs arrived in 1842 in Paris and was actually lured over there by Lieutenant General Count de Rumigny, because he already met Adolf Sachs in Brussels.
Right.
He was really impressed by the knowledge, the persona of Adolf Sachs. And he decided to lure Adolf Sachs to Paris to bring some extra competition for the French instrument builders. Because in those days, if you wanted to do business, you wanted to supply the army with musical instruments.
Right.
That was the most important contract you could get. And the French instrument builders, they actually all cooperated. So like factory A made this part, factory B made that part, another factory, another part. And then in factory D, they assembled everything. So everybody cooperated and they always got money in and they became lazy and started doing sloppy work. But hey, where would the army get their instruments else? So they decided, you know what, it's okay this way. So that's how Adolf Sachs basically arrived in Paris. And he started working. He didn't share his work. He did everything himself under one roof. And his competitors didn't like it. The problem was that the quality of his work was so high that the poor quality of their work was really very obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when the hatred started.
Right.
And although he lived in Paris, they always called him the little Belgian.
Hmm.
The Belgian guy. And they really, well, they hated him, basically.
Yeah. So how long does it take you to build a saxophone? Do you go by the same technique? Do you do it all yourself?
No, not yet. Yeah. I have several parts made elsewhere because, I mean, some of the machinery I need costs $300,000 to get. I would need that machine for like one day a month. So that would be a bad investment. That's why I work with other factories that make parts for me
right. After
my design, then I assemble them.
Right. You know,
that's how I can make it affordable because
no, I understand.
If I have to acquire all those machinery myself, my saxophone would cost a fortune.
Right.
And I think if you have to sell one of your kidneys on the black market to get enough money to pay to get a saxophone, I'm not doing a good job. I don't want that.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of smarter people than I am, they come to me and they say, hey, Carl, you have something very valuable. I mean, you have to raise your prices, make it really exclusive. I'm like, you're right, but that's not what I want to do. I mean, I don't want to be exclusive in my ivory tower looking down on people. I want to make saxophones the way I want them to be made for me. And one of the criteria is don't make them weirdly crazy expensive.
Right. They look very, very wonderful on your website. And I really like the names you have for them. You named them after the various, cities in Belgium. And there's even one named Paris. How did that come about?
Well, I mean, in business, they always ask you to focus on a group. Like, what is your target audience? Like, everybody. I don't want to choose. Of course, my heart, my passion is jazz music, but I want to make saxophones for everybody. So that's how I came to the several series, like the Dinant. Well, that's my baby. That's the ultimate jazz saxophone that I wanted to create. Then you have the model Brussels. That's silver plated horn. Mm-hmm. That's more of an all round. Sounding horn. Then you have the Paris, and the Paris is more of a classical setup. And then you have the Bruges, and the Bruges is, well, that's going to be a model that keeps on innovating because that will be the 2.0 version of what I already have. Constantly trying to do research, new technology. I'm working together with universities, and I'm really on top of new technology, basically. Mm-hmm. And I'm continuously developing through the Bruges model.
Right, right. You had mentioned when we talked the other day that you had a friend who had like the largest collection of Adolf Sachs original saxophones in the world. What's his name? Have you used any of those saxophones in some of your designs or influence how you manufacture yours?
I always, Leo van Ostrom is, he's from the Netherlands. He lives in Amsterdam. And he's world-renowned collector of original Adolf Sachs saxophones. And also all other brands. He has so many saxophones. And he wrote a very good book about it, 100 plus one saxophones. That really good book. You can find them bookstores in the United States too. And I knew that I had to meet him. But I was kind of, intimidated because I already had some negative reactions. A lot of people were not so happy that I revived the name Adolf Sachs. But I was like, okay, I have to meet this man because he's been some sort of a hero to me. So I sent him an email and I said, Leo, I'm Carl from Belgium. I'm reviving Adolf Sachs. Is it okay for you if we meet? And he just sent me a short answer. Yeah, that's it. Perfect. You're welcome. This is the address. So I drove to Amsterdam and I rang his door and I was kind of nervous for his response. Maybe he would think that I was doing sacrilegious stuff. He opens the door and he immediately hugs me and he said, finally, somebody does something with that brand name. And he kind of adopted me. And that's also how I met his other friend, Nico. Nico he has quite a reputation. He is called the Emperor of the Saxophones in the Netherlands. He's a crazy-ass technician. I mean, and his appearance, he's kind of character. And I really like him. And I remember that the first day that we got acquainted, we talked hours and hours about saxophones. And he opened his collection of saxophones. And then Nico said, hey, Carl, okay, I see your prototype, but maybe you should change this and that and that. And it was, it turned into a very important friendship. I actually focused on the old saxophone.
It's great that you have access to some of Adolf's original saxophones and more than one, so you can use that for your research. You did use it for research, right?
I did. But I have to say that the most things that I took over and a lot of things that I applied to my saxophones come from old American and old French saxophones.
Hmm.
I mean, Edel Sax, he made crazy good saxophones, but it would be weird if the saxophone would not have developed after Edel Sax invented. So a lot of other brands picked up on saxophone production, and they really brought in a lot of innovations, like the microtuner that the Con saxophones have. Mm-hmm. I really like that. There are a lot of interesting details that you don't find on modern-day saxophones anymore. And as I said, I tried to look back on why did they stop using this or that on the saxophone. And sometimes it was because, well, it was not as functional. But a lot of the things that disappeared from the saxophone were just dropped because it was too much labor to make those parts. It was too much work. I was like, hey, but if this is good and functional, I want to bring it back.
Hmm.
So that's how I started developing my saxophones.
So what have you brought back that left?
Oh, a lot of details. Like on modern day saxophones, I hate the adjustable thumb hook.
Mm-hmm.
The design of those thumb hooks, ergonomically, it's a hell. And the adjustable fact is, well, you only need to adjust it once to make it fit better, and that's it. And it's a lot of material, a thick plate, a thick screw, and you don't need that. So I looked at thumb hooks from old American saxophones. Again, the old American saxophones really made a big impression on me. And that's what I brought back. It's an ergonomically well-shaped thumb hook, and I soldered it on the body.
Hmm.
And so no adjustable screw, no extra mass on the body. I tried to remove excess weight from the saxophone.
Hmm. Hmm.
What I also did was bringing back the key guards of the King Zephyr.
Right.
King is another great American brand that was out there in the days. And I really like this wire rounded key guards that especially was used on the King Zephyr, but other brands and makes also had that style.
Right.
But it was specifically the design of King Zephyr that I used.
Hmm.
Also, I have an element that was used on the gold medal of SML. That was the French brand.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually quite in demand back in the day, and they were actually a big competition, that specific model, for the Selmer models. And they had on the neck socket, so when you put the neck on the body, the ring to tighten it, they changed that. Instead of making one cut and a screw that tightens it, they made four cuts, and they made an adjustable ring around it, a rotating ring that you could tighten. And that's actually quite genius, because if you have one cut and one screw and you tighten it, if you do that for decades, you start getting an oval shape because you tighten it on that one spot.
Right.
And with four cuts and the rotating ring, you have even pressure all around, and you have no leaks and no malformation. So those are just a few of the details that I adopted from Sax.
Mm-hmm. You have this other project that is extremely interesting. I went to your website, and you have to talk about it. Sax for Packs. You have to I'll let you go and because it's so interesting, and people need to hear about it.
Yeah, Sax for Packs. I don't know if people understand the word packs, but packs is Latin for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was 2014. Yeah, it was 2014. When I saw the Old Testament prophecy of Isaiah, and it's also a verse that is in the UN building, near the UN building in New York, that says, "And then they shall beat their swords into plowshares."
Yeah. Let's talk about sacks. Yes, that was the first part of my interview with Carl. Very interesting gentleman, isn't he? Great project he's doing. Gonna conclude it next week with the second part of the interview and add a little addendum on the end of that about his web presence, as we always do here on Let's Talk About Sacks. My name is Jeff Robinson. Website is letstalkaboutsacks.com. Want to thank Reactor Productions for this theme. Come on, let's listen to it. Yeah, I love this theme. Want to thank Joe Stewart for sound reconstruction, Anchor for podcast distribution. Want to thank Rebecca Robinson for editing, and my editor, and Miles Robinson for inspiration. And want to thank Levitate Web Solutions for podcast production. Again, let's talk about sacks. I want to thank Carl for the first part of this interview, and we're going to get to the second part of it, like I said, next week. So we got more, ladies and gentlemen. Let's talk about sacks.com. Let's go.